Hello, I'm Martin Kessler, and you're listening to FlixWise Canada. Joining me on this episode is returning guest Tony Stella. Hi, Tony. How are you doing?
Hi. Thank you for having me back. I always feel like you have these really great ideas for episodes, and you invite me really kindly. And the last time was for the Actors' Revenge, and you were like, oh, the Criterion cover is coming out. I know you did some work. Would you like to come on to talk about it? And then a year later, I sort of got on the same sort of with today's topic. You were so kind to invite me, and you were like, that's a great idea. And I think it must be at least a half a year later. And you had a great idea. You were like, when At Eternity's Gate, the Schnabel film came out, and I posted all these posters I had done, and you were like, wouldn't you like to come on to discuss all these movies about Vincent? I was like, oh, this is probably my favorite topic ever suggested for a podcast. So I was like, yes, let's do it. And then it took forever, and now obviously all kinds of viruses has come in between, but I'm glad to finally do this.
Thank you. I'm glad you're excited. I've been hanging up sunflowers in all the meantime anticipating your arrival, so it's been good.
Yeah, I really feel like I'm the Gauguin here.
It's impossible.
I painted him for you.
It's very friendly of you,
Vincent. We're going to be talking about films that are based on or inspired by Vincent van Gogh. And that's about as good as I can do with the last name. I should give a shout out to past guest Matthias van der Roost for giving me some pointers.
Matthias, please don't be too hard on us. Also, all my French friends, please. This is going to be a butchering of all sorts.
Well, sometimes even within the films themselves, I noticed that the pronunciation of the last name is different. Even within a single film, you have Van Gogh and Van Gogh. And
yeah. I mean, Stella Schnabel is probably the worst example. She comes in at Eternity's Gate, and she really goes really American, and she's sort of, oh my god, then she does sort of a French weird thing, and then it's Van Gogh, and it is really jarring, and you're like, it really takes you out of it. It's like, could they decide which one it is? So I'll settle probably on Van Gogh, but it might alter.
It might. Whoever's listening, please don't judge us too harshly, but I don't think anyone will, because it's one of those names that just gets butchered a lot. I think that's why I heard he would sign his paintings just Vincent.
Yeah.
Because nobody could pronounce his last name. So, yeah. You know, we might say Vincent a lot.
Vincent and Theo is great, yeah. And it feels so personal. I mean, this is probably why it's so enduring over all these years, because through his letters, we're so close to him. So it feels like everybody has an ownership of his life in a weird way. Mm-hmm. You shared it because he shared so much with us. So Vincent feels appropriate because you read it over and over, reading the letters. You sort of see Vincent and Theo. So you feel really close to them in a way.
I think so. I think that's a big part of why his life can connect with so many people. And what's really interesting to me looking at these films is points of his life are pretty well defined, and his life is quite well documented, and the films are so different from each other. Everyone knows, you know, the time in Arles, the time in Saint-Rémy mental institution, the time in Auvers, but how each is treated in these films and how, you know, certain details or aspects of his life are treated are very, very different. So that was interesting for me to see, like, okay, you know, how's this filmmaker going to approach this aspect or this period of his life?
Yeah, there's so much to tap into, and there's sort of all these little pockets. You could do just the early years or Paris, or you could do the whole, you know, cradle to grave classic biography. And lucky we have this totem of a film, this Lust for Life, which is sort of my personal entry into all of this. But like you said, to compare all these different movies is that I feel, because you got this giant looming masterpiece, it's interesting that everybody else has sort of an idea and they react to this film almost, or to this book, or in general to the myth of Vincent with an idea. And sometimes these ideas are really obvious and disturbing because you can see it so clearly, like, oh, I'm not going to show any painting in my film, or he's not going to look like Vincent. And you're like, ah, this is annoying. Why? But other films, I feel really... like in the Altman version, you find that they can condense a very personal issue for them, and it's not so much about the giant masterpiece or the big life. It's more about a personal relationship of the brothers, for example. And so,
yes.
But you, like you said, through the letters, my father used to ram this home to me all the time. It's a German saying, "Wer schreibt, der bleibt." Who writes stays, kind of translated. And in this case, it is true. Like, Gauguin is probably a much more, I like Gauguin's paintings more, but because Vincent has left such a clear pathway through the letters, and they're not ramblings of a madman. They're very precise. They're very clear.
He's very eloquent, very very cultured, thoughtful, philosophical even. Yes.
And there's such a guidepost for any painter who starts out. So they're still very useful, because he's not this kind of like we see in the later movies, this dreamer or this lost, you know, ravaged madman. He writes about business. He writes about career decisions. And that comes sort of from his biography directly. He was in on all of that. He knew the business of the galleries. And he sort of saw through all the bullshit. And that's very clear and still very helpful because he goes into such great detail. And then about his personal technique and experiences and different subjects. And you can kind of read along while seeing the paintings. So this is just still to this day, I think the letters are the keys to any kind of approach to Vincent, whether you want to ignore him, whether you want, but mm-hmm. you got to deal with them. And I sort of, a lot of the films later, they kind of throw the letters away, which I find really puzzling always.
It is. I think, like you said, part of it's sort of a reactionary approach. You know, some of the later films, you can tell it's not a biopic so much as it is a thesis. This is my take on Van Gogh. And I mean, sometimes it works or sometimes it's interesting, you know, to varying degrees of success. Like, I mean, the ultimate one, I think just the first two shots really basically set up what that film is about in a lot of ways, which is the painting at the auction being sold for millions and millions of dollars. And then it cuts to Tim Roth as Van Gogh. And he's, maybe that's the only film version of Van Gogh where, just looking at him, I'm like, oh, he probably stank, like the Tim Roth one. Like, I don't particularly like that version. I like Robert Altman a lot, but I don't, that's not one of my favorite of his films. But it's such a strong approach to make a film where it's like, yeah, his paintings sell for millions of dollars, and here's him in total poverty, total misery. It's making a point.
Yeah, and I would say, as a structure, for me, Lust for Life is a very personal way. I love this film. Mm-hmm. I've done probably more posters for this film than any other. I think over 10 versions over the years, and I just love Kirk Douglas foremost. Of course, he just kind of passed away. So what a tribute! Just fantastic, and I love him in this, and for such a Hollywood altering hero, that he would bring in all this darkness and the anti-hero, but also then to take on Vincent, because he thought he looked like him, but then just play this artist where there is no clear sort of romance, there's no happy ending, and it's sort of a really daring, great feat by him. But then Tim Roth is sort of taking over the entire movie and kind of hijacking Altman a little bit. And he admits to that mm-hmm. that he lets, this is comes, you know, in 81, where he breaks from complete Hollywood system and he starts to do a lot of theater, and he does a lot of collaboration, obviously. And I feel this really is the movie where he admits that both Teal and Vincent, the actors, Paul Reiss, they write a lot of the scenes themselves and they offer a lot, just sort of like in theater. And then Altman just kind of sits back and lets them do their thing. So they go, Tim Roth, it's really, he's Trevor from Made in Britain. He's just like, shut off, motherfucker. He's just sort of Alan Clark, you know, punk.
I think, doesn't he say sawed off at one point? And it just sounds so strange coming out of Vincent.
He's such a, he's sort of punk Vincent, I always call him. Like, he's, and that, although I don't like it, and he, like, the kiss and all this stuff is when he kisses Gauguin, he has the knife, he drinks the turpentine, and he eats, almost like touches the pigments. He's sort of an instinctual animal, and you can saw these are all actors' ideas he brings to the table. And that's, in one way, it's really disturbing, but it's also kind of disturbing, not in a way like I'm shocked, but disturbing. It kind of takes you out of the movie because, you know, it's not thoughtful. Vincent, you would never think that this guy actually sought a religious path, you know.
That's the thing that kind of throws me off. You know, Altman can be so, like, some of his films are so naturalistic, the performances. And if this one, I mean, it was a made-for-TV movie, but it really feels like, I don't want to say a film to play, but it has that, like, BBC TV documentary kind of feel to a lot of it, except it's more extreme. You have the prostitute that Vincent fell for, Sien, pissing in the chamber pot. And, it, you know, it's sort of like, it's such an abrasive film. Like, the opening music. Like, whoa, like, who thought of this for a Van Gogh film?
Yeah, exactly. So we have three films from 1990, which is interesting. So there must have been this, I can't really remember, even though I saw almost all of them in the theater, there must have been this real culmination of some kind of a Vincent year or something, I remember. And everybody sort of had the idea to do Vincent again.
Right. Well, the Maurice Pialat film, it's so quiet. It's like the opposite, where
it's another reaction. It's like, you know, I don't know whether he saw the Altman version, but that's sort of the American big blah. And then comes the French version, which I probably like the Altman better, but that's because many problems we can get into later.
Well, the Pilaf film, it's so French. It's really... I actually kind of like some of the style choices and the quiet of it. Like, it's almost like Bresson or, you know, some of the later drier films like Gertrude. It has that kind of staid quality where everyone's very soft-spoken and slow and there's not really music. So it's just like this very low energy film by design.
Yeah, and it's sort of also, as we talk in a bigger sense of painters' films and what is necessary to embody this, I feel, and what Kirk, of course, Kirk Douglas gets to right away, we like this guy. He appears and we're on his side, and this is really crucial, and it's called instant. It has to be a chemistry thing. And Jacques Dutronc is obviously like a hero, a French national icon. It's an interesting choice because he's a pop star, François Hardy's husband. And so this guy's cool. It's a cool idea to use somebody, an actual pop star icon, to embody this guy. But it doesn't work. I mean, you feel nothing for him. And I like him a lot. He's great in interviews. I love, he's a cool, simpatico man. But yes, sort of they took a different approach and almost feel like, yeah, they didn't really talk. And Pialat throws him under the bus later because Dutronc wins the César for it. And he kind of, that's Pialat's problem. Like, he can't accept any success, right? He's like, oh, yeah, Now I'm being liked. I don't like to be liked. So Dutronc brought all this energy I'd never liked about the film.
Because I think, like, Dutronc is kind of the best thing about the film for me, actually. And for me, a lot of the issues sort of come from the narrative, which is very, like, it's sort of about his last days in Auvers, but it's a very fictionalized version of this. Like, and it's in some ways very contrary to the Vincent that comes through in the letters, and it's really more historical fiction.
Because, yeah, and it's a shame because Pialat himself was a painter, so could have brought so much more. He actually made, in 1965, he made a short for TV, Vincent van Gogh short, and that's more poetic and to the point than anything he achieves there. And it's sort of, yeah, he edits it nicely and puts very good music to it. And there you go. Solution. Wow. What an amazing thing. And then later he sort of forgets all of that and they get carried away, especially in the dancing brothel scenes where you really feel this is now, I'm watching like a theater troupe having fun. But the audience is like, what the fuck? How long is this stuff? And Godard remarked he loves this. And of course, for me, that's right away. Like, oh, it's horrible. Like, yeah, that's not even a compliment anymore. Like, he admires what he does there. And I'm like, how long is this scene? And it's like you said, Dutronc brings, he's interesting. And when,
yes,
I really appreciate, I thought about this later because I saw it at the time, I hated it. And now on the rewatch, I saw a lot more good in it. But what he brings, and I think he read the letters closely and he found that before he arrives in Auvers, actually Van Gogh visits Theo, his brother, in Paris shortly before that. And he sees that a lot of his paintings are not up in his apartment anymore, but actually in storage. Yeah. And sort of this is after he's been very productive coming out of the asylum period and he's working again, he sort of breaks down and he arrives in Auvers really not manic, not in one of his things, but in the deep depression where he says, he writes down in the letters like, I've failed. All these years in Provence have come to nothing. And he feels very betrayed. And maybe the way Dutronc like really shuts us off as the audience, like we don't, I don't like Vincent there. He's really not to be liked in it. You know, you are, he's not sort of the outside. He's just locked away. And maybe that's his parameter for this. And you kind of respect, you're like, oh, interesting, an interesting take. But you can never get close to him. So whatever he goes through until his death, like you said, it's more of it's an essay.
One of the biggest choices in it is to not show him shooting himself. It cuts to him just holding his stomach as if it's no different from anything that's come before it.
He passes sort of through the communal, the hotel where he's staying, and the family is like, is he not coming to dinner? He sort of just slinks up to his room. And that's very much how I imagine it, whether we believe he's been shot by somebody else or he committed this himself. But it's sort of, that fits again with the letters. It fits with the accounts that he's sort of just there and he's like, don't blame anybody. And that's sort of the big linchpin for the conspiracy guys that they brought out this book. They're going like, oh, why would he say that? You know, it obviously must be somebody else. But it's very much in touch with sort of saying like he wants to end it. I mean, he predicted his own life ending at 40 in his letters, way before, in the beginning of his letters. So he sort of feels like, after this, I'm working at this. And sort of the heartbreaking thing that we know is that right at this moment when he's sort of dying on the bed, his reputation is picking up. He's being invited to exhibitions. Theo is able to be able to sell. So it doesn't take much longer for him to get love. That's all he needs, a little love.
I always thought if he had lived just a little bit longer, I think he would have been a success. You know, I think in his lifetime, it was so close. He was a painter for a very short period of time. He started late in life, and most of his famous paintings come from the last 2.5 years of his life. He was just so prolific, and he changed so much so quickly. You know, I think you look at other contemporaries, it took them a long time to find success. And I think probably, you know, what comes across from his perspective, it's almost like, you know, he failed at all these other jobs early in life, and, you know, this was just one more thing he felt he had failed at, not realizing that he was there basically already, or just about to be. So
it's interesting how you would have dealt with success, because for painters especially, this is a big part of why a lot of them go insane, or why I, for example, mm-hmm. opted out of the art world, because I didn't want to go down this road because I knew it hurt too much. Or what Basquiat did, or what Schnabel did really well in the Basquiat film, which is one of my favorite yes. painters' films. It's that navigating that sea of bullshit, as he calls it, going through that system of the gallery market, and then actually being success can actually be more harder to deal with than not having success, because you always have that way out. And Pialat himself feels very much, that's why I'm so sad he didn't have a bigger insight into this, because he is exactly under this. He can't live with praise, but when you don't give it to him, he's clearly hurt. Vincent, in the letters, he writes to Theo and Terstig and his gallerist. And so he's like, don't sell them. He's like, don't sell them. The oeuvre's got to stick together. So he's kind of in his own way, if you want to see it. But he's building very consciously, very clearly, an oeuvre, a collection of paintings that have to stay together to get the value. He doesn't want to sell them off too early. So I feel he's also in his way, very knowingly, very smartly, that he doesn't want to ship it out too quickly. And this is a great insight for young painters. And so he did the right thing. It's all coming to bloom. Just wait a little bit, you know, it's almost there.
No, I mean, that's a big part of why, like, eventually after Theo died, Johanna, his wife, managed things. You know, she had this big collection of Vincent's artwork, and that's one reason why after his death it became popular and people recognized his art. I was going to say a little bit earlier, like, in the Pialat film, you know, there are moments where you sort of get the sense that it's the stupid praise can hurt as much as criticism. You know, there's a couple of moments where Dutron kind of, like, he almost looks into camera when Gachet is, like, you know, talking to him about art, and he just looks so fed up with him.
It's my favorite stuff, the beginning, which is quite joyful still, because it's not long yet. You're not going through all this brothel stuff and stuff. So the beginning is so joyful when he sees Gachet's collection, because he's clearly an amateur.
And when Gachet's like, he didn't even comment on the Renoir, and he's so upset.
And that's beautiful stuff, because Pialat knows he's a painter. He knows those stupid discussions. And I always love art talk. Always, always, always. If it's an 8.5 or Manhattan, it's great when it's sharp and in there. I love that when it's sort of a wink and on the thing, but also you can now play with it, and that playfulness is in the beginning is there, and I appreciate. So this is why a lot of these painters' films are very difficult, because painters' lives, except maybe for, you know, Rothko or Vincent through the murder and all this stuff, it's not very interesting, because the actual action in the painters' lives is so private, and it's so, you know, changes from second to second, and it's all in the action of painting, and that's hard to show. And so this, the ultimate special effect is always like showing the painting. And if I feel if you're copying out here, then you really don't have anything. You need to show the painting. So I really get giddy when they show it. If it's bad or not, I want to see applying paint to canvas. And they all got a little splash and dash of it, but Pialat starts off really, and I'm like, oh, great.
There's more eating than painting in that movie, I know.
Exactly, and I'm like, oh, are we seeing actually action? And then he makes all these clever shots through mirrors and windows and show the guy and don't. And then you're like obviously becoming like, oh, now it's in my head. You're avoiding it. It's a shame. Schnabel and I was hoping so. I was expecting a lot from this film. I love Julian Schnabel a lot. He has a lot of critics. He's probably a giant asshole, but he's a great, great painter, which I always appreciate. I love his painting, and he brought back a lot of the myth into painting, which after the 70s had been lost. So he himself is responsible for reinvigorating painting with a new kind of, you know, pathos, with an opera that has been lost. And so when I love Basquiat, Before Night Falls, I thought, wow, this guy can also do films. It's amazing. And then sort of he drifts off in Miral. I didn't like it all. It was like political. And
Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Yeah, Diving in the Bell and the Butterfly. Great ideas, but again, like one or two things. I don't know if it all comes together. So when Vincent was announced, I was like, and who plays Vincent? And oh my God, Willem Dafoe. Yes. And oh my God, and oh my God. And I'm like, this is going to be amazing. So I did all these posters and looking forward to it. And I had not seen it and I missed out on it and then sort of was gone. And I heard a lot of bad things, but I was like, they don't know. I'm sure it's amazing and it still looked amazing. And then I was so disappointed because I was hoping from Schnabel not only to not step in any of the pit holes of this topic, but also to add what he did in Basquiat. Many people don't know the Basquiat estate forbid to use any of Basquiat's art. So all of the paintings you see in the Basquiat film are by Schnabel. So this is, I thought, was always such a great thing that he manages to do analogy of Basquiat paintings without actually copying them. And in the scene when Jeffrey Wright paints in the basement to kind of blue Miles Davis, it's one of the best painting scenes ever committed. It feels so real and it feels so authentic. And I was like, oh my God, we're going to get this in Provence. And I wanted to see almost like Schnabel paintings. Yeah, don't use any Van Gogh, but just
Van Goghs you've never seen before.
Yeah, exactly. And he kind of does that with the roots, but they're too close. And then you see some of the portraits of Gauguin and really kitschy, awful copies. Mm-hmm. And you're like, why don't you? It almost feel at the end, I wish he would have made a book of photographs with just, you know, Defoe. And staging them and then maybe using them for a cycle of paintings rather than making a movie, because it all doesn't really come together for me.
Although visually there's so many things that I love about Eternity's Gate, especially like taking the more subjective approach. And there's those point of view shots where like it's tinted yellow and there's sort of I don't know if they were using a lens maybe or what, but it's like a, you know, some kind of optical effect, so it's fuzzy. But I'd read a while ago some article that's saying Van Gogh might have been taking digitalis, which is made from a foxglove plant, to help with his epilepsy. And like apparently a side effect could be coloring your vision yellow. So I'm like, oh, like he's trying to literally put you in what some people think Vincent might have been seeing, and like doing things like that. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I was hoping it was more of a Minnelli take, because Minnelli structures his film in these five parts, and the light and the yellow is the last in the symphony, and yes. He structures it like we talked before about Konichikawa. He has thematic light, but that's very interesting, and I'm sure you're right, because Schnabel also, I mean, he's no research slouch and he knows all this stuff, so even taking on this kind of new book and Vincent's murder and all this stuff, he's very up to date with all this stuff. So I'm sure, like, you're right, that's very interesting. I didn't know that. And I love, for example, the burnt sunflowers. That's an Anselm Kiefer painting. Mm-hmm. I mean, he knows, he takes from art history and not just the old masters, but right now, that the Anselm Kiefer dream sequences are clearly there. They're friends, they admire each other, their painting have a lot to do with each other. This expands. But I was just hoping for Vincent, maybe it's Defoe's fault. I don't know who to blame here. It's like Defoe is just such a dreamer. His Vincent is just such a Nell. It's just running through the grass, and he's just, and I wish it's, I think they ignore the letters, but also Altman distrusts the letters. He says Vincent staged himself, but that's clearly not coming from a painter. There's so much valuable information, and he's so honest about the technique, at least. Maybe not himself and his suffering. Maybe that's a pathos thing. But please use him as a painter. And he's sort of just a wunderkind seeking the light and then climbing. And then there's more wonder and he's running. And it's just in the beginning. So I play this game, right, when I don't like a film or it doesn't start right. Yeah. I don't know whether you do this or not. And I'm always like, okay, it should start here. Oh, no, or maybe it should start here. And it's like, as the film progressed, I was, okay, here, it should start here, all this other stuff, cut this stuff. And I wish with at Eternity's Gate, it almost stopped. Vincent comes in the door in Arles, start. The wind is howling. He's there with this heavy equipment. He clunks it down. You see how heavy this stuff is. He's alone. I'm like, okay, please start the film here.
It's such a Wild West intro, like that stranger coming into town. I mean, the PLA film almost does that, like him coming off the train. But
exactly. Yeah. We know all the Vincent stuff. Don't go Goga in the tavern. He looks like 60 years old. He's supposed to be 26. You know, like he's already haggard and he doesn't know anything there. And then we see him years later and then he's finally an owl and still doesn't know anything. And you're like, oh my God, it's such a shame of a kind of drama point to pick. So it gets later and later in the film and I always wish it would start. But sorry, yeah, to make this before your idea to crash down, I think this is the moment where I love the film and I right away also out of it because he shows you this burden of the guy and it's very different than a lot of the beats just take Kirk Douglas's performance. I mean, even though we get Punk Vincent from Tim Roth, it's very Douglas, if you compare the two, he's throwing things. He's very passionate. He starts to work right away. But Defoe is sort of, he's just hollowed out by the Mistral. He just arrives in this shitty room and stuff. And then right away we get this idea by the sort of floating video camera that gets put on the ground. And we're not alone with Vincent. We know there's somebody there filming. Schnabel makes us really conscious of that he's being observed, and maybe that's a meta take, but I'm like, I don't want to feel all these ideas, you know. I feel them. they shouldn't be so obvious, you know. I start thinking, what is he telling me, and I'm out of the movie.
Right. Well, like I think that just that take on Mungo is sort of like an innocent martyr more than the tortured genius, especially the scene where Vincent's speaking with the priest who's played by Mads Mikkelsen. Like, you know, he sort of calls back on his theological training. And my mind sort of went to Defoe as Jesus in Last Temptation of Christ. And like, I was thinking like, oh yeah, like, you know, this Van Gogh, he's supposed to be like Jesus in the Schnabel version, basically, or like a sort of Christ-like.
Yeah, but he's so naive Jesus. Like, he doesn't know what's coming. He doesn't know what's happening. He doesn't know. And that's sort of, it's really hard because, again, like with Kirk Douglas, I love Defoe. So when I heard it and I see the likeness and I'm like, oh, they're trying. So this is for me the signal where Dutron is like, fuck it, I'm just wearing a goatee.
At one point, there's the line in the PLA film where they said like, oh yeah, he cut his ear. But like, his ears are both on. That like, there's no effort to change the way he looks, I know.
And then with Defoe, I love because it's just this haggard, it's almost a bony. And when they stage the paint, this is also something what I love in all these films. It's sort of like the Bond films where when there's so many films on one topic, you kind of want to hit all the beats and see each director's interpretation of it. So for Vincent, obviously, what's really important to make the paintings come alive. And the best from is Lust for Life. But also, I love what Schnabel does here when he cuts off his ear and then he's in that self-portrait with the fur hat. And that's you're like, that's also the poster. That's why it's so great. It's that heightened yellow. It's the heightened green. And it's really from his work. And so much of it is so clumsy. When the children attack him, it's not making that link that he clearly is capable of. And I'd love if it would all look like that, for example.
I think you're right that I wish more of it was like that.
Yeah, because in the Minelli, of course, we haven't talked at all about my absolute favorite.
Lust for Life is the classic. I think probably most people, this might be the version that they'd see first, is Lust for Life. Like, that's just the kind of go-to one. And then the rest almost feel like, okay, like, how do we add something or how do we add some perspective or change things? But one thing I think Lust for Life does is it finds like a really strong structure. Like, you mentioned the five-act structure and it's very classic Hollywood, but in some ways it's giving you a lot of things you wouldn't expect from a film of that period from Hollywood. Like, it's commentary on religion. It's just, like you said, the downbeat ending. I mean, it's hard to have like an uplifting ending when you're dealing with his life, but like, just all these choices for a Hollywood film like that, and to come across the way it does, I think it's really remarkable. It starts earlier than any of these other films. It's before he even decides to become a painter. It's when he's working as an evangelist in Belgium. And just, you know, that's also like, I feel like the Jesus metaphor, it's not as hammered hard as Eternity's Gate, but you know, you sort of get this idea that he's living very humbly and trying to help people and trying to find something to give to people. Like, you know, Kirk Douglas, he has these moments where he talks about, I have something, you know, I'm not being lazy. Like, I have something I want to give to the world. I just don't know how. And you sort of get the sense that he got kicked out of the church Van Gogh because he was, they said, like, poorly representing them. But you sort of get the sense they would kick Jesus out of the church if they could have.
Your clothes are ragged and dirty.
There are people here who have no clothes at all. Do you mean to tell us that you actually sleep on this dirt and straw like a beast of the field?
That's not
you, the spiritual leader of the community.
I gave my bed to a sick woman who needed it more than I.
You are new in this work, Mr. Van Gogh. I have no doubt that you mean well, but the fact is that by your behavior you have degraded the dignity of the church whose representative you are.
Have you no sense of decency?
The falsehood of the church, like the falsehood later, the falsehood of the salon, are done away in one scene. Bam! Economic. Minelli. Right. It's theater. It's Broadway. He knows how to stage this. And it's so much fun. What a lot of people might think is the kitsch version, the overdone version, the mythologicalized version that you have to take down now. I think the further we are away from this classic Hollywood machine with all its opulence and stuff, the more special it gets. It's not negative for me. I find myself becoming more and more old-fashioned, going back in Metrocolor and cinema scope, and I'm just in love. I always loved this film, but this is especially dear to me. It's one of the first films my father showed me because he always wanted me to become a painter. My father had the letters next to his bed in the 80s. He's a theater director, and he comes from that world, and it sort of was very en vogue to read those letters always as an intellectual or something. But so he read to me from them early while I was sitting in his bed as a young boy, and he read those letters, and so the myth of Vincent was always present. Of course, I was fascinated with the ear, and I was fascinated and all these little children's things. And so I saw the Kirk Douglas version early. And of course, I love Kirk Douglas from The Vikings. And he's kind of my Ulysses. You know, it's all these childhood films that I have. So when I saw him take this, it was a shock because it was not my hero that was on stage. He's vulnerable here. And he hits this 100 miles an hour running this thing. I mean, the candle scene, you know, how the fuck did they do this? This is not.
I think he just really did it.
He really did it.
I think so. It's
so hardcore, and he hits every note, though. Every time you think he's going overboard and he's becoming really bombastic, then he breaks down, and he's really, I mean, not easy for a man. Like, I mean, he has a barrel chest, he's a superhero, but he's a trained gymnast, he's a wrestler. But later with Gauguin, he leaves him the whole stage and he becomes so submissive.
What's amazing is Kirk Douglas is a big guy, and then like Anthony Quinn comes along as Gauguin and he just towers over him. Like maybe not physically, but just like his screen presence. Like it's on purpose, where like Gauguin is basically like the cool kid you want to hang out with, and he's the person who seems like he has all the right answers.
Yeah, and Kirk Douglas hits it. He's annoying. He's hanging onto his coattails. You can understand why Gauguin leaves, and it's his performance. You can see him crouching. He makes himself smaller. He bows down, and I mean, these two were born for this role, and they were itching to do it. I mean, they were really. Minelli just came off Kismet, a giant production, which then was finished by Stanley Donen because he was rushing right away to Arles. This is filmed on location. That's why it's so special. And it's based on the Irving Stone novel from 1934, which wasn't a big hit at all. It kind of came and left, but it's sort of hit the zeitgeist at this moment, post-war, runaway productions, a lot of things shot on location. And Minelli comes and he knows how to do this. I mean, we are arriving with a master. Freddie Young does the cinematography. I mean, Lawrence of Arabia. I mean, this team is like all-star after all-star after all-star. And they're not sort of under contract, and they're not sort of, you don't ever have the impression that these guys are doing it for the paycheck. This is a passion project that comes through the production design. And the reason also why this sings is Minelli controls all aspects. He know, he comes from these just gigantic Meet Me in St. Louis. I mean, where he does period research that still to this day stand out to see. So even when it starts in the minor, they have such distinct sets, the cinema scope. Coming from theater, he does very little cutting, so he preserves a lot of the performance. A lot of the things are, you see reaction and action in the same shot. I mean, something going on in the foreground, background, midground. This is really stage Minelli. And when all the actors and artists meet in Paris, and you hear all the big discussion of the salon and what's en vogue and where the impression is, I mean, it's just so joyful. You're opening this giant picture book, and Minelli is so sharp and so economic in this Hollywood machine at work, that everything is driven, like you said, everything furthers character and plot. There's nothing wasted. And it's a big, expansive period they're covering, but every scene is so sharp and furthers him and shows him in a different light. And intercut with all these real paintings that they, you know, the film starts with all thanking all these collections.
The use of the artwork is really extraordinary, especially like in the CinemaScope, the way it, like sometimes it'll just cut to a montage of the artwork at key points in the film. And it's really effective the way that's employed. Like it almost, I mean, this is obviously before Andrei Rublev, but like it made me think of the end of that film where that's a little bit different, where you have the long black and white and then finally you get this big reveal of his paintings in color at the very, very end. But it sort of has a similar effect when you're watching this, where you just get overwhelmed by just the paintings themselves. You know, it just lets you see them and it's moving just in their own right. It sort of says like, you know, these paintings are powerful enough. We don't need to dramatize too much around them or anything in their presentation. Just look at them. You know, when he's at the asylum in Saint Remy and he just looks out the window and they go into the paintings, you know, it's so beautiful and it's like, you know, makes you want to cry almost, or you know, it's very, very emotional. It lets the emotionalism of his paintings just speak for themselves, and I think that's a really effective choice.
Yeah, Rosa is a super epic music. It starts like ba ba ba, and you're in an epic. Yes. You know, he scored the Four Feathers, the Killers, Double Indemnity. He comes from Billy Wilder, and he gives you this. Just, I mean, it opens like a big. It's an MGM signed movie, so they're very proud of it. And Minnelli is their prime director at this period, so he is really. It's a very specific. A lot of dedication was given to it, and you see, as coming back to the paintings, like that sequence you mentioned, the walled garden and the asylum. Vincent painted because he was so keenly aware of an oeuvre that he painted a lot of series, a lot of repetition. So he paints this walled garden. So we see one painting. It cuts to Kirk painting another the second version, and it cuts to the third version as the painting again, which is the painting in the rain, one of my favorites, where it's just sort of slashes of rain. And so, and this is done so seemingly you never perceive it unless you analyze it like we do now. It became really obvious to me, but I never noticed this before. You're just sort of like in this well of emotion, like you say. It makes you feel for Vincent and his plight, but it also makes sure that we see what Vincent sees. Like, how does he arrive in this circumstance? So these color arches that we see, the beginning is the earth tones of Belgium and Holland. It's very dark and brown. Then it comes to green of Holland and The Hague, and he sort of comes up. Then it comes to The Hague comes then red and blues, yes, and the cityscapes. And then at the end, it comes all together like this crash of influences and the impressionists. And I mean, it's a marvel, and I love this film. The standout, like, to stay on the paintings, is the Potato Eaters, which Vincent's regarded as his first. He used to make a difference between sketches and paintings, so he only called paintings that were kind of done, and that was the first painting he called a painting. And we see him painted, and the actors with kind of prosthesis or something are made to look like these goblins from the Potato Eaters, but it's done. I mean, I appreciate it so much that they do this. This is the special effects I want to see. It's so kind of like in Charles Laughton's Rembrandt film when they do the Night Watch, and you're like, you have all those characters, please play with that. I'm just so thankful when I see that. Like, I love that they did it. And obviously, even then, it must have been daring, because like, is this going to be awful when we, you know, we stick a plastic nose on this woman to make her look like the painting? But it's not. I mean, I just love that they did it.
Well, it's always tough when you want to represent an artist's work in a film about them in the visual style, but you don't want to go overboard or make it silly or make it too affected. Like, it's a tough balance. Kurosawa's Dreams, it kind of gets around that by being a dream. But, you know, the first thing you see is the bridge, and you go right into it, and you have paint right on the structure to make it look just like the painting, and that the colors are done, and eventually like it stops being locations and you just have special effects. So the Kurosawa stand-in is wandering literally through Van Gogh's paintings. It just sticks you inside them in a really amazing way. I love like the special effects for that, where if he's passing down the road in front of a tree, he goes behind the tree. Like it's sort of a 3D effect that's really amazing. And Van Gogh's paintings just lend themselves to that a little bit naturally, like the texture of them.
It's the touch of an old master, because it's obviously super silly and light and leggero. It's like silly, but he can get away with it because he's Kurosawa. At the end, he's a great master. He can sort of just play with this and make him wander in the painting and actually speed up the walking, you know. So he's sort of marching through it in a fun funny way, but it's also, I mean, I was delighted when I saw this. I mean, okay, we have to make a big break here because okay. Dreams is your favorite Kurosawa, and yes. I know this from knowing you on Twitter and all these things, and you're one of the people, I mean, everybody listening to this probably knows this, though, that you're one of the people, I really respect that about you. You're one of the people that have very different takes often, and it always feels really genuine. I mean, to call Dreams your favorite Kurosawa is so fucking daring, and I would never say that, and a lot of people would say it for effect, you know, because obviously want to be different, but with you I know it's always real, so I'm always wanting to get into, I was like kind okay. of half doing the episodes, I mean, because
there's never going
to
be a better time than this.
How is Dreams your favorite Kurosawa? I mean, I know I'm obvious, you know, I mean, I think Seven Samurai is the best film ever made.
Seven Samurai probably is the best film ever made. I love so many Kurosawa films, it's hard to even have like a single favorite, but Dreams was the first one I'd seen, and I saw it very young. I think I might have said this before on Twitter, but it was actually in the children's section of the video store where wow. I rented it. I think just because it had a kid and a rainbow on the front, somebody just slapped a sticker on without watching
yeah,
the movie.
Be a war, yeah.
but for me, it's even today the sort of film that makes me want to create, and I find it very important to me because it inspires me. Getting into Kurosawa's painting, Kagemusha and Ran, like, I love the feeling that you're watching like a living painting, and Dreams, it's maybe taking that even further than Ran. It's not as epic, obviously, but it's, in some ways it is an epic. You know, people assume that it's, all these, you know, little sections are disconnected, that they just exist in isolation, but you watch it and it's a man's life story from the inside out. You're watching a childhood dreams and the dreams of a young man, the dreams of a man who's been to war, the dreams of a man who's afraid of nuclear war and the future, and you know, finally sort of the dreams of a man who's getting ready for the end of his life and sort of coming to peace with that. It's a really, really beautiful film that I think in some ways is a little bit misunderstood, and like visually it's so extraordinary from one story to the next, and the kind of range of emotions you get from strange and funny to scary to tragic to ultimately uplifting even in the face of death. So like for me, it's a really, really special film.
Yeah, I mean, I think you unlocked it just now, and I figured that was it, that the first touch with something is always really important. So I saw Seven Samurai first, of course, sure. And that I was never the same after that. And so I saw Dreams in the cinema, and I had such, I mean, I'm in high hopes for it. And I was so disappointed when it came out, because the only section basically which I like was the Van Gogh. It was like, oh my God, I was just amazing that these worlds and the bridge scene, like you say, that you can step into a painting. I thought that was marvelous and insane and great. And then later, of course, through the years, I revisit the film and I'm like, I remove myself further and further from Dreams because I know more about Japanese cinema now. And of course, you know, he had the Club of Four Nights where he was yes. with Kobayashi, Kinoshita, Ishikawa. And I just always find that Kobayashi did Kwaidan, which was like just better than Dreams, or even the Ballad of Narayama, where I wish Kinoshita, I actually made side by sides when Eternity's Gate came out, because I always linked those two films. The Kinoshita Ballad of Narayama is a studio film that is so heightened it becomes a painting, it becomes so over the top studio that you just marvel at the sets, sort of like in Kaidan, where it's just this stroke of like a brush stroke across the sky, and that's the sky, and it's so abstract, and it works so well. And I always feel the 1990 Dreams is just a lesser version of all those directors, where I've seen that Dreams and I feel Kurosawa lets us in on nothing.
The more I read about Kurosawa's biography, the more I start to see things in the film that seem like they're just under the surface. I mean, the segment that we're talking about, one thing it sort of made me think of is how he related to Van Gogh. And he had quite a few things in common, like just thinking about where it comes within the film and where that would come relative to his life. You know, you think about his suicide attempt.
But it's almost like comical suicide. The locomotive from Dodescaden rings, you're like, woo-hoo! And he sort of shot up, and you're like, oh, there goes Vincent, there we go! And then it's sort of the crows, and he's like, yeah, whatever.
But it's also very Van Gogh to deal with maybe the darkest period in his life in this very kind of light, whimsical sort of way. And
which I loved. It's always called him, because we always call I always called Punk Vincent. This is Toothache Vincent. The Scorsese, when he met Scorsese in New York for some Scorsese preservation of film, and they met, and after that, he already remarked, like, oh, Scorsese, he reminds me of Van Gogh. The way his energy is Van Gogh. And this is famous for a lot of Japanese people. They judge every Westerner in this weird, like, oh, this is Van Gogh. He's a creative person. And you're like, oh, what? Really, Scorsese? Van Gogh? I don't get any Van Gogh vibes for Scorsese. But maybe, then I was thinking about, again, Scorsese's very manic, sort of like me speaking here. He's very excited and that's and very interesting. That's probably how Vincent was when he got excited, you know.
That's what comes across to me, like when they talk about the excitement and like he thinks fast, he talks fast, and that's kind of what comes across.
A scene that looks like a painting does not make a painting. If you take the time and look closely, all of nature has its own beauty. And when that natural beauty is there, I just lose myself in it. And then, as if it's in a dream, the scene just paints itself for me. Yes, I consume this natural setting. I devour it completely and whole. And then when I'm through, the picture appears before me complete.
To give this role to obviously another filmmaker, not a painter or somebody else he admires, but he sees him in the light, and I'm like, Scorsese obviously jumped to it right away, and they shot it in Hokkaido in those giant wheat fields, which obviously pine trees. Which,
yeah, it doesn't quite fit.
But I didn't notice at the time. At the time, I was so delighted that you could do this kind of reverse of Purple Rose of Cairo, that you step out of the screen into right. the audience, and here you step into the museum canvas, and you're inside. I always love this encounter when the film develops this freedom. There's another Woody Allen obvious link to Annie Hall when they revisit his childhood in Coney Island under the roller coaster, and he's sort of just stepping in and he's looking at his own family right. dinner, and he's sort of step, and here you just encounter Van Gogh, and Van Gogh is like, not he's like, yeah, well, why are you not painting? Why, what are you doing? Let's go.
Why aren't you painting? To me, this scene is beyond belief.
I love this possibility in film, and it's not a big dream or anything. It just sort of happens, you know, let's go. And are you aware, just because I didn't know this, Vincent and Me, it's a Canadian film.
I heard about it. I didn't have a chance to see it before this episode. I tried to find it, but...
Me neither. I just saw the last scene on YouTube as I was looking it up, because I'd never seen it, and the poster looked so awful I'd never even considered it. It's sort of a young girl, and she paints like Van Gogh, she's inspired, blah blah blah, but at the end she encounters Van Gogh in the field. She goes and steps through time, and she sort of meets him, and they have a chat, and he's sort of, oh, you're gonna be a painter, that's great. And they sort of have this, the end of the film, it's, and they both were released in 1990, so that's a funny weird coincidence. I wonder, obviously I'm not sure Kurosawa had anything to do with that, but it must have been also this dream to encounter Vincent is obviously, which comes out in the last kind of Loving Vincent film that we have, that it comes out that this desire to be in touch with this work, not only, but to be in touch with this tortured genius as they probably see him, is such a strong desire. And then what they all want to encounter is a version that they all bring to themselves, you know. I'd meet the different Vincent than you would meet, or that Schnabel meets, or so on.
Sure, there's a little bit of self-portrait in how we relate to him, I think. You know, you read those letters, and it's so easy to identify with him, but you also put your own spin on it. It's impossible not to, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, one person's interpretation of what he's like is going to be a little bit different from the next, but... You know, I think that was Kurosawa's. And like I heard also, like Kurosawa also had maybe a similar kind of epilepsy. He would stare off and, you know, like certain similarities.
He was very sickly and stayed home a lot as a child and drew. I was definitely drawing. And like you said, the later storyboards for the later films, I've got all those books where they become more and more and more. And from Daudesca down on, where it's sort of his first exploration of color, which is also another link that I made years ago on Twitter. This is sort of one of the great painters' films, so it's From the Horse's Mouth.
With Alec Guinness, yeah.
And the Daudesca Dennis and him, they're very, very similar in the use of primary colors in this almost childlike way, but then they heighten. I mean, it's just beautiful. You're kind of on stage with them, and that's in 58, I think, The Horse's Mouth, yeah. And Jimson Gully, he portrays this painter, and Alec Guinness' performance is beautiful. It's very earnest. It's a funny movie, but it's himself. He doesn't make fun of the process, and that's a very good key to the paintings are kind of silly and over the top and naive, but his performance is brilliant as a painter. It unlocks a lot of the ways how to do it. You can make a funny film, but still they show him painting, and it's a really nice bridge between the worlds. And yeah, and which I always thought that's a cool link, which I know Kirk Douglas visited the set of Redbeard.
Oh, I didn't know that. I mean, he's a real Redbeard. That's interesting.
And I just thought everybody came by that set.
I guess they were filming for such a long time that you probably got a lot of visitors because of that.
And so I always thought that was a cool anecdote. I wish I could have sat in on Kurosawa, like, remarking on Lust for Life and just like, oh, did you know Minelli or anything? I don't know what they talked about. Probably Spartacus or something.
Could have been. I don't know. Yeah. Well, like, Kurosawa, also his paintings look very inspired by Van Gogh. Like, I have a book Zachary Curl sent me, which is like a book of art by filmmakers, and all the Kurosawa paintings, not just his paintings for the films, but like just his paintings in general, they look very, you know, Van Gogh inspired, and
they got looser and looser.
They're almost scribbly kind of.
Yeah, but more and more. They got so much that he almost kind of, in this period where he had to take the rest, obviously after Suicide, and the funding was drying up and all these things. I mean, this is again an American production. It's Spielberg, ILM, George Lucas, and sort of he was in exile, sort of after Der Ursula, again struggling after making this masterpiece, and then nobody picks it up again. It's sort of very sad. And then he starts on Ran and Kagemusha to really finish the film on paper before. And I mean, it's so helpful for his collaborators later, because he can basically go like, look, this is it. The color and the side-by-sides are always fun to do because it's so accurate. I mean, Nakadai is that really the costume. They get it all from these wax crayon scribbles.
You look at Kagemusha and Ran, like the way that the makeup's done, or like even more I think in Ran than Kagemusha, but like, you know, that heavy makeup, he like turns them physically into the painting. It's not like bending the painting for real life, it's bending real life to look like a painting. It's so incredible, you know, those like the muzzle flashes on the guns and everything, like it just looks like a painting. It's so beautiful. One thing that I always heard, I don't know if it's true or not, but they say like Van Gogh is the most popular painter in Japan.
Oh yeah.
And to me that was always very interesting, because Van Gogh was very inspired by Japanese artwork, and especially like the ukiyo-e woodblock prints, and he has all those studies of Hiroshige.
That's a big reason, because Japan as an island culture feels very misunderstood, and then Japan, especially how they are seen in the outside world, they're very insecure in a lot of ways, which puzzled me because it's such a strong culture. And when they get accepted, like when you try, I lived there for a while, and when you give in, they're so proud to show. And that was a big Van Gogh at the time, being in the pantheon of the great painters, that he was so inspired by Japanese prints, and that he so clearly writes in his letters he wants to get more graphic, he's very clear about this. It's a big sense of pride. And in the 80s, I remember when Van Gogh was tripling and doubling every fucking auction, there I forget which, maybe the lilies or one of the sunflowers,
I think one of the sunflowers sold to a Japanese buyer in the 80s for lots of money. Yeah, I think nobody's seen it since, right? It's still like hidden away somewhere in some vault. I don't know.
He's like, I'm gonna get buried with it, and nobody else gone. Everybody was outraged, of course, but there's the death of the samurai. And then Japanese suicide is honorable. It's you're taking yourself, you're the last consequence of, if you, before you betray what you're doing, you are taking the last step, and you're not a burden on the others. You are taking the world. And I think that's a huge cultural touch point for a lot of Japanese people, with the Van Gogh story, with the Van Gogh myth in general. Not just, obviously, loving the art is, of course, the biggest, I guess. But outside of that, you can take ownership. A lot of people can take ownership, because a lot of, we all have struggles. And by him bearing those so obviously, zeige deine Wunden, like Boyce said, show me your wounds, it's powerful. It's more powerful than all these winners. Who wants to see winners all the time? Right. I mean, all my heroes are basically giant, like, you know, have giant tragic lives. And I always think when I marvel at like how nothing is going right, and I'm just like, look at how your heroes were. You know, I'm like, oh yeah, damn. It's like, you got to be careful. Oh, that's a real problem I have with Altman, because Altman says, I didn't set out to make a film about painting. I set out to make a film about a failed painter. And I'm like, oh my God, you have not got this at all. He's not a failed painter. Are you crazy? I mean, it's like, it's nothing to do with financial success. Like it's so stupid. It's like, why are you making a Van Gogh film in the first place? I mean, it's really at the core of a lot of problems with that film, with that series that I still love. I still like, there's a lot of more good in it than bad, but it's Altman's kind of like not really grasping. I think he is more interested in the relationship between Vincent and Theo, and that's very clear, and it's not about the painter Van Gogh. And That's, of course, for me, that's a, it's a shame, because I think Tim Roth has the chops to go there, even though it's like his very much his young actor's interpretation of it.
It almost makes sense to have an older actor play Van Gogh, because even though he was young when he died, like there's something very old soul about him, I think, that always comes across. And you look at those paintings and like he looks so worn down and so kind of weary that it makes sense to have an actor who's maybe a little bit older today playing him than somebody who's young up-and-comer like Tim Roth, you know, who's in some ways flexing his acting abilities in that movie.
Of course, we meet Kirk Douglas and he's supposed to be 26, and it's, I mean, that's obviously not him, but that's the power of movies. I mean, who cares? Yeah. That's not interesting. Can you convey that youthful lust and later the depression and sadness? Can you do it or not? And sort of if they hit one note, it's obviously he has to play over this whole giant tapestry where they all get to sort of just grab a passage. I mean, the Altman is probably the next one has the biggest, longest period. Yeah, because we do see his kind of Holland period. Yeah, I saw that film probably on TV. I don't know when I saw this. I saw this and I didn't like it at the time because it was so gruesome. It was so like...
Yeah, it's deliberately provocative, I realize, but it's like, oh, I don't want to watch this. Like, you know, it's just sort of really trying to rub your face in the idea that, yeah, he's a bum.
Yeah,
you know?
And it's missing the magic. I mean, I'm not saying maybe a lot of people regard it as the kitsch, but again, what Minnelli does, it establishes this link. How do these paintings come about? Because when you see all the filth, you're like, how do you make these paintings? Where this one of my favorite shots, when Kirk Douglas's head is down and he's sort of having an absinthe, and he's the camera pans up as his gaze pans up, and we're in the night cafe. It reverses the gaze. We're in the painting, and the painting's sort of moving, sort of what this horrible loving Vincent doesn't achieve. All of a sudden the painting is moving and we see the billiards being, but just so slightly, ever so slightly. It's not a big la la la. It captures the atmosphere. There's no music. And we see Vincent obviously see, oh, I must paint this in red. And I must see those lights flickering. The power of the movie does this, that we are not able only to see the finished painting, but we're in the process of him discovering the painting. And that's just, I mean, I appreciate that so much. I don't think any other film about painting gets there quite like it.
It's hard, because how do you dramatize? Like, I think some of my favorite films about painters don't take an obvious approach. Like Andrei Rublev, like there is no real painting, obviously. Like it's sort of, you know, showing in some ways the process, but the spiritual process to get to why you would make a painting like that, why it would be important for that time period.
Showing us, how do you arrive at your vision? How is it? You're not like,
exactly,
just
yeah,
like, you know, whatever. And then all of a sudden, boom, there's all this color and you're like, what?
Or another one I like is the Mike Leigh's Mr. Turner, which, you know, it doesn't show his like creation of his vision, but it shows an evolution of his vision over the course of his life.
It does very well. It's the last I think I've seen of all the current movie films about like big painter films, and I was really surprised. I always go in really grumpy and I'm like, this isn't going to be good. Obviously this was very good. I like Mr. Turner a lot, because yes, it does show you those. He steps out the door and there it is. I mean, it's Margate. You know, if you've been to Margate, you see Turner, and it's just still present. And it's very well done there. Obviously very Mike Leigh sensitive to an artist's experiences. They never go full force in the wrong direction. You knew that was going to be handled well. And obviously because of the problem, what we want to see most is the process of painting, and very few films can achieve that. I think another sort of, if we call out our good painters, who could be a good painter of the actors we know, there's a few. I really love Nick Nolte in the New York Stories and the Life Lessons segment, because he comes across very naturalistic as a painter of the 80s. You believe Nick Nolte instantly that he's a painter. And it's and a lot of people, like, who else I thought was always going to be, I wish William Hurt would have been a great painter, because when he plays in Smoke, you know, when he plays a writer, he could pull it off. Gary Oldman pulls it off in Schnabel. He's Schnabel's alter ego in Basquiat. Obviously all those type of guys. James Mason is a great painter in Age of Consent.
Oh, that's right, painting on the beach. I forgot about that.
Yeah, and the gallery that Helen Mirren stuff, I don't know.
Let's make Lolita but sexy.
Yeah, it's probably wrong, but all I remember really well is the gallery scenes, because him in that tweed suit and the knit tie. And I know a lot of painters, my grandfather, we've been in those circles all our lives, and so I know how they come across, especially of that period, the side of 50s, 60s painters, English painters. And that was spot on. I mean, great James Mason. And Yeah, and then right away there are films that I have a problem with because of the casting. There's so much and never lets me in Derek Jarman's Caravaggio, which is beautiful, but it's played by Nigel Terry, who looks perfectly like Caravaggio. Great choice, but sure. Nigel Terry is just...
The one I always think of as my go-to example of a similar thing is Ed Harris in Pollock. And like, he looks the part and everything, but it's just something about that film really doesn't work for me.
Yeah, because it's Ed Harris cannot let go of being Ed Harris. Pollock was really tormented by the success. Like, that's another story. That's a James Dean, obviously, like
Die Young, and
yeah, and he couldn't live with this shit. And they get through all the beats, but it's sort of at the end. It's like, yeah, it's in that realm of Anthony Hopkins as Picasso, which was like,
oh, that's another one.
Yeah, Picasso was awful, and they're like, okay, great, but I'm really not into that.
Because I mean, a lot of artists are abrasive people, you know. And one thing I like about Lust for Life is, on one hand, you get exactly why people might not want to be around Van Gogh.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's still sympathetic. Like, I think contrary to some of the other versions, I mean, the Pilar version, like, it's sort of not that sympathetic towards him in some ways, I think.
It's really hard because we are basically watching because of the importance in history, but nobody ever on the screen makes you care for anything. And something needs to lock you in, whether you feel for Theo, I don't care, the prostitute, somebody needs to be there where you go, okay, 2.5 hours, I'm doing this to myself. I don't want to just get to, is it a murder or not? I mean, that's just not a big enough character.
One of my favorite takes on Vincent's life is, it was never made as a film. I wish it was, but the Leonard Nimoy one-man show where he's playing Theo, and like, it's sort of him after the funeral kind of reminiscing and recounting, and it's so effective. Like, I find that approach works well because on one hand you can say that, you know, you can identify with Vincent, but it's really hard to really understand what's going on inside somebody's head, so it in some ways it makes it easier to identify with Theo and understand his relationship. And it's almost like, it's not the same thing, but it's like, oh, let's do a biography of Mozart from Salieri's point of view, you know, like it feels a little bit like that. And I kind of wish that somebody had just made a film of that, because it would have been so simple. And Nimoy plays it so well, you know, where he's this very sort of, I mean, already you associated with the Mr. Spock in Star Trek.
Perhaps you're thinking of my one-man show about Vincent Van Spock. I mean Van Gogh. Damn!
That reserved demeanor as an entry point into somebody who had emotional bursts of energy and, you know, was so emotionally exposed in some ways that, like, I found that actually to be a really narratively successful way into Vincent's life. And
yeah, because Nimoy knows the key to all of this is the letters. We are getting all the beats from the letters. That's why it's so valuable that I think just read from the letters. And for example, in Lust for Life, this is a funny anecdote as well, Theo's son, called Vincent Van Gogh, funnily enough, there's a big correspondence with MGM about him forbidding them to use the letters. So all the voiceover of Theo that you hear in Lust for Life is sort of the gist of the letters, because they were actually legally not allowed to use the letters. But it's very successful. Right. I mean, I read all the letters and you don't catch it. They're very good. They find a great way around it. But I appreciate a voiceover in most of them, and sort of just to pick us up at some points where we see, also to counterpoint, like Nimoy does very well when he switches roles, and when he gives you, he reads something, he quotes it into the room, and then we see with the slideshow something else, or we see a counterpoint. And it's, like you said, it's very successful. It's almost like an art installation, a conceptual piece of art have you seen his documentary?
Yes, yeah, about his research into his life. And
yeah, he does like a European vacation in a Volkswagen. It's so simpatico of Nimoy again, that he does after, like you said, Spock and all the stuff. And he's, of course, like a way, he has so much bigger interest than being locked down into Star Trek. And it's great. Like, yeah, I think that's the Kirk, the same impetus that we love this guy already. And here he is. And he's great. He gives us a different take on something. And all it takes, the theater trick, is to put on, you know, the painter's the blue shirt, and then he's Vincent, and then he switches back, and it's really clever and nice. Yeah, I wish I'd seen that on stage.
I'm glad it was filmed at all. Like, some theater productions, like, I think, oh, that sounds like such an interesting interpretation, and there's no recording I can have access to for some productions. So I'm glad I was able to see that.
In terms of just staging the possibly biggest painter's film that there is now. It's a documentary that's Clouzot, Le Mystère Picasso, where we see Picasso over a series of days just without a shirt. He's sitting there in a hot studio, and these two masters come together, Georges-Henri Clouzot and Picasso, and he's just filming, and we see the process. Like, that's probably the best painter's film ever made, but that's, of course, the luxury of having Picasso in his late big prime himself just drawing and drawing, and he cuts between Picasso himself, you see his facial expressions, and then back to just how does the line appear, how does he make the vase into a rooster, and then back into, and it's so fascinating. It's probably the film I've seen most of any painter's films, because you're just so marveling at how something gets created like that, and see the master stroke at work. It's just really a marvelous document, like probably the best there is of any of these. And yeah, and then another thing where the painter, obviously that's the dream scenario, to have the person in there themselves, is Downtown 81. I did a big podcast all about that film on Filmwax Radio, where I talk about this sort of lost treasure, Edo Battaglio, Glenn O'Brien film, where Jean-Michel Basquiat is in it himself, and they capture that sort of downtown scene in New York at such a prime moment, and you see Jean-Michel just before he breaks through, and you see all his eloquence and his sophistication and his beauty and his sort of, he's just entrancing, and he's sort of himself, and he's so assured and so young, and you're like, wow. I mean, everyone's in it as themselves, and this great Marie-Paul, fashion moda, it hits authentically all the things. And then it was locked away, forgotten, and sort of forever. And on the re-release, when it came out, it was sort of this Pandora's box of marvels that came out, and you're like, wow. And it connects you so much to that. It was called New York Beat as well. It connects you to that New York Beat of the time that was so influential for my generation. I mean, that was basically our treasure trove of creating, was only, you know, those brief 10 years in New York that they all hit together in this moment. And this film captures it so perfectly. And my compagnon, my friend, Midnight Marauder, he's done the reissue poster for it. Was showing in the Metrograph again, and he's done this really beautiful poster for it. But yeah, that's some, these two are examples of like the painters obviously themselves being in it, which is amazing, a stroke of luck to have, and it sort of, nothing can come close. But of the sort of dramatized versions, there are like obviously Tarkovsky, like you said, and I love The Horse's Mouth. John Huston, Moulin Rouge is another really good one, and 52, like the Toulouse-Lautrec movie, that's sort of a big picture book as well. And the Rembrandt, the Alexander Korda one with Charles Laughton is really fun. Just the Sunday movie greatness, because you just revel in Charles Laughton being Rembrandt. It's sort of really cool from. And then the Mizoguchi, obviously, which I know you love. I love that one.
Yes.
That's another really great one. How do you integrate the works and sort of the last shot of that movie? It's so great, because you see as he gets, you know, freed of his handcuffs that he's under, and you see those. Now he's unlocked, and all these drawings just fall and fall and fall, and all these prints at the end as the shot, and this creativity is unlocked, and we get like, how do you show him paint? How do you show that creative process without being able to show the actual genius? That's like a really, it's like a really big feat. And I think, yeah, if we want to mention, that's sort of your homework for me, which I've avoided, but I've braced myself for, to finish off with Loving Vincent.
Right. The animated take on Vincent's life. It came out almost the same time as the Schnabel film, right around the same time. It was sort of, like you said, 1990, 91. Like, it's the same thing. Like, you could get a little Vincent burst all at once.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It got a lot of attention. Did it win an Oscar? I don't know. But it was mentioned on all the festivals. And I was very, something about it didn't sit right with me.
It's a testament to the cheap labor of animators.
Yeah, exactly. To be fair, I watched it. I wanted to watch it. And I really, I don't want to be too nasty, because I don't want to diminish the effort to speak, because it is a monumental task to do this and have everybody draw these single frames and oil paintings. And even though a lot of digital effects, however, on it, which I sort of feel like a betrayal, where you go like, okay, either you're going to paint all this stuff in oil paintings, but then don't please animate the smoke and the rain on top. And like, now you're diminishing all, why to do this in the first place? It's sort of a big conceptual piece, but without being aware that it's a conceptual piece of art, it's sort of, I find to be maybe too harsh, but at the end, like, what it sat with me was like the final embodiment of the commercialization of the great artist becoming like puzzles and mugs and mouse pads and in the museum gift shops. It was sort of this well-meaning thing like, oh, we love Vincent. And so we're going to start with this animation of retranslating all these other things that we can't see from his painting also into paintings to give you an insight into his vision or what? I mean...
Yeah.
What I did, what was sort of fun in watching it, what I think everybody get deprived in the cinema was pausing, stopping, pausing, pausing. I was doing that during the entire movie.
I did the same thing.
Yeah, it was sort of like examining the paintings, and they're quite interesting. And at least in the color segments, there are really marvelous things in there, really nice stills of paintings where you go, wow, that's an interesting transition. Cool abstractions happening in corners and reflections in windows where it's sort of really rough, and that gives us much more aura than I would think this digital thing. I mean, that makes sense that it kind of justifies the oil painting approach, but then it gives you this nervous, like undulating tentacle feel the whole movie, because you obviously see the brushstrokes the whole time. So it's like almost like the boar in Mononoke when all these worms come out of him the whole time. It's like, blah, blah, blah. It's like, you're like, what? It's like a really weird sensory thing throughout the movie that's creepy crawling everywhere and never leaves you still. And I was maybe instead of all the aviation love, maybe this would have been a great Studio Ghibli kind of, I love how Ghibli gets always like, you know, it's like France, Belgium, Italy, Germany, all mushed together into this European fusion vision Heidi-ness of Japan. That would have been really fun to see like a kind of Van Gogh take, young Van Gogh and an old and Miyazaki style take. That would have been really cool.
Another thing that's in both of the two recent ones, Loving Vincent and At Eternity's Gate, it's the theory that perhaps Van Gogh was murdered.
Yeah.
And At Eternity's Gate especially sort of treats it almost like a fact. You know, there's this theory that's come out within the past couple of years since the last biography, very recent, that maybe Van Gogh was murdered by a 16-year-old kid named René Secretin.
Yeah.
Who was harassing him. And there was like a whole backstory about how he went to the Wild West show in Paris and he would go around dressed like Buffalo Bill with this revolver. And it's a theory that's gotten some traction. I don't know if I necessarily am convinced by it. Like, I think it's compelling and there's enough kind of question marks around Vincent Van Gogh's death that I can definitely see it. But it's sort of weird how, to me, it was weird that it wasn't played ambiguous. That I think it even ends with like text to the Eternity's Gate film where it's just like, oh, he was killed and didn't say a thing.
Yeah.
So, which to me, like, it's a very ambiguous thing.
I was very puzzled that Schnabel was one of the proponents of this book, which happens a lot in these historical things. Obviously, now there's a new take on Vincent, everybody runs with it. But I'm almost questioning myself. Like you say, there's enough there when I read up on it. I was entirely unfamiliar with this book or even the thing.
Yes.
And I think I had such a hard time accepting it because the narrative of Vincent, and whether it's hammered home through history so hard and we just take it as text, or because that's how I love to see him, so for me it's like that's how it is, or whether life is just more sloppy and doesn't make sense in real life and it's more sadder and always danker and darker and more less concise, that makes you believe kind of, oh, maybe there's something to it, all this great effort, and it's like some dumb kid shoots him, you know. It's like, yeah, it's so sad, and then he slinks to his room, and you know, even though he predicted his death would come at 40, and maybe he wanted to die at 40, and that's why he got murdered, because he was only 37, you know, so that's another proof. So enough things, like you said, they add up, they're weird. Maybe he sort of, which I think the Piala or one of them, either the later ones, they kind of think he gave into it because he was already fed up. And even if he'd been wounded, it was one of these things, please don't fix it. Like, I really resented that the Loving Vincent was leading us down this evil Dr. Gachet, and they're all like,
Gachet comes across pretty bad in some of these movies for somebody who is on most accounts like a very nice guy. Like, you know,
yeah, like he takes him in, he sort of takes care of it. Yeah.
The only thing that Vincent ever said that was sort of negative about him is he's like, I don't really think he's gonna be able to cure me. It's like the blind leading the blind. He's sick in the way that we're all sick, you know.
Yeah, they have him like steal the paintings before he's this body is cold, and one of them, you know, he's like kind of it gets played up in a sense in every movie, and he was harassed by the children and he's sort of the village idiot in a way. And even Lust for Life, when this probably never happened in the Yellow House, just after he cut off his ear, they're all like yelling outside, climbing up the drain pipe, opening like, the window.
The Minnelli film, that's, you know, it's meant to be expressive, it's not meant to be literal. But the Piala film, like, it's mostly centered around this fictional relationship between Vincent and Gachet's daughter, which you read about Vincent, and like, probably if anything, he had a thing for older women, but you know, it sort of implies that in this film they have a sexual relationship, and like Gachet at the end kind of finds out, and they don't show exactly what happens with Vincent, so like, you don't know if he shot himself or somebody else shot him, but Dr. Gachet is like, well, you know, it won't do any good trying to help him, like, just basically let him die. Like, it's such a cold moment. I guess just for the sake of drama, you know, that's historical fiction tends to do that.
It ends with that note. And then the next card, it's sort of like after he did 70 paintings in 2 months and in 66 days drawings and then death. And you're like, wow, but we never saw this frenzy.
He looked like he's doing anything but painting. I know.
Slinking about being miserable. And then like, and he's always like all the women throw himself at the feet, like these way too beautiful prostitutes. Those prostitutes are so insane. That's why I saw PLI is like loving filming this brothel scene, because he just wants to hang around all these young actresses who adore him. And he's the boss. That's why the scene dragged on and on. That's sort of my speculation, because you look one more beautiful than the other, and Vincent's sort of like, eh, whatever, you know, totally not like desperate. Like, oh, another great scene in Lust for Life when he's at the brothel, how Minnelli uses every instance of him trying to get close to the women, and he's obviously distolerated because he leaves some money there, but she hangs her bracelet on his ear. This is such a tiny little gesture of like, they're coquettish around each other. But it's suggesting so much of maybe then later that would transform in his mind. Like, how do I give her a present? How do I show my love? How now I'm remembering the sensation of having this bracelet on my ear. And for us, the audience, it gives such a little sting to what's to come, because everybody sort of, especially in the 50s, we are waiting for that ear to come. Like, how are they going to depict that? And the way they depict it afterwards, it's done so fantastic, because we see sort of the mirror and Kirk really goes to town with the razor blade, and he's sort of wrestling his face. He pushes his face up against the mirror, and then we hear this crescendo silence. He drops out of the frame. And then with a delay, you hear the scream, and then the music kicks back in. And all you see is, as he's rushing past the mirror, is this tiny smudge of almost like a painting again, this red signal. Mm-hmm. And that's all it is. And it's so magnificently staged that we feel all the horror and the gruesomeness much more than when Tim Roth is sitting there like butchered.
Although I thought maybe the mirror was like a little bit of an homage to the Minnelli film. Yeah. They have to like go one up by having it like smashed so it's shattered. And, you know, they kind of go overboard with it. But it's like that image of that scene gets so burned into your head with the film that, you know, wait, did it really happen that way, or am I just thinking of the movie? It sort of tends to happen sometimes.
Yeah. I think to deal with this sort of, everybody's waiting for the ear. So the people who are not after the paintings are waiting for the ear. Like, that's such a big seller.
It's the one thing that the average schlub who doesn't know anything about art, that's like the one thing they know about Van Gogh.
They all get it slightly wrong with the scissors and sort of, and Altman, because he's so hurt by the critics and because he's hurt after Popeye and because he goes away, always feels like, yeah, I'm going to show those critics. And you feel that he even wanted to choose a left-handed actor. He wanted to find a left-handed actor just to show the critics, like, fuck off, because then they would all point out, oh, Van Gogh wasn't left-handed. And he would go, ha ha, you're not in the film. Like, he goes that far, and he's that self-conscious that I find really sort of in this exile period where you feel he's really unhappy. Now, obviously, this marked the transition back into his second, you know, renaissance with the player, and sort of accepted again after that. But
this is sort of right before that.
Right before that, yeah.
This is like his last days in the woods.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it sort of gives him maybe confidence again that they're shooting in all these beautiful locations in Amsterdam, and he's a master.
The locations are really fantastic, actually. Like, the outdoor locations, all the buildings they shoot around, you know, and like, I watched it for the first time in HD, which, like, you know, for a TV movie, it holds up pretty well on the big screen. Like, there's some details that are obviously meant to be on the small screen. Like, you know, you can tell that the way the teeth are blackened and stuff like that, it's sort of, some people are just going to watch it on TV. They'll never have to see this blown up. Or, you know, some of the reproductions aren't super great, but like, for the most part, it looks really fantastic, actually, in HD.
Yeah, I have a terrible DVD ITV collection where the cover is so atrocious.
Oh, the old DVD I had, it looked so crummy. Like it looked like grayed out and just the new version that's available now, and I'm like, oh, like this actually this is a good looking film, even though it's like very dark and gloomy.
Yeah, there's the scenes in the cafe where they sort of take liberties of him becoming like real punk rocker and he's painting his face, which is, you know, like they would do, and it's historical, but I think Tim Roth obviously has the gusto to deal with this is really cool. And I always see the hints of this blackness with some red and yellow in there, and I'm questioning this probably could have got a real good impact if I wouldn't see it like dragged through mud. But yeah, I think it really worked also well this time I watched it as a movie, whereas before I watched it on TV.
I think I might have borrowed it from the library, and I like it better now, but I still don't really like it.
Yeah, I don't really like it. It doesn't want to be like. But in light of the newer ones, especially I was so let down by the Schnabel one. I was hoping so much, and maybe it's not fair. I mean, for me, it was like, I love Schnabel as a painter. Especially another link that I thought about with the Kinoshita film, that Schnabel had this series of paintings. This was the first series that I really fell in love with, where he had old kabuki screens that he painted on. And he sort of dealt a lot with found objects, obviously, in the 80s. And that was so gorgeous. He got those from Japan, and he was sort of improvising on top of these kabuki screens from real used discarded screens. And they're beautiful paintings. I made a lot of side-by-side on Twitter with Schnabel paintings, Kinoshita across, and then Eternity's Gate, because I was really willing it sort of on Twitter with my scrapbook to like put be looser with your own paintings and sort of, but he would obviously been torn down, like, what an asshole already is, puts himself in there, and like he would have been awful. But I feel it would have been worth the hate, because I feel Schnabel's pretty immune to being, you know, hated. He's pretty dealt with this all his life and staged himself as such a guy. I felt it would have been worth it to just really, like, show yourself sort of as Vincent, have somebody play, but be more like more open in the process, that we really see Vincent working on like giant paintings that are obviously way bigger than anything sort of Schnabel size, you know, and then everybody having to deal with those, what is he doing in the field, and he's working on his 20 meter painting of the field and the bombacity of Schnabel with that. And it ended up being so much less of everything that I was like kind of like but yeah, I mean, maybe after the initial disappointment I'll watch it again, and there, like you said, there's so many very beautiful images in there that it's almost like a book for sure. It's just like they worked in the trailer. I was like, wow,
visually that was the thing that was strongest for me, and it's just, it's a different approach than something I've seen before about Van Gogh's life, so I like that. And it's sort of funny too, like each film kind of works in these little like theories visually about what might have been the cause for Van Gogh's mental illness. Lust for Life, you have the drinking the absinthe right before, or in the Altman and the Pialat film, like everyone's got syphilis. And of course, also the Altman film, like he's constantly got the paintbrush in his mouth, and it's probably
he's drinking the turpentine. And I always wonder, I mean, I'm 100% convinced Tim Roth did that. There was no water. It was like, he's gagging, he's throwing up the turpentine. He's like, he's hammering on the table. And Altman sort of removed, and he's like, let him do that. Why not? Let him try that. But yeah, I really, that is sort of the only, I mean, that gives us his justification. Again, I think that he goes there. It's sort of like you said, this guy is obviously sick from the beginning. Like, Tim Roth is never, he's never whole from the beginning. He's always a pest. Like, and where I find Kirk does really well, this kind of, I want to be of service, like you said, in the mining scenes. And then ultimately the church comes in and they're so false. And then he falls, like everybody that he's trying to cling to, they're sort of rejecting him, or he feels out of sort, or he's sort of really, he's earnest and eager, and he always comes off annoying. We all know those guys, and we've been those guys. And it's sort of, that's why it's so identifiable, that you like, he's in search of just belonging and friends. And
he goes in just like a little bit too hard, and that chases people away. And
exactly. And Gauguin's like, so brilliant the way Anthony Quinn plays it.
I'm not one of those painters that gets off the train and turns out a sunlight effect before he's even unpacked his bags.
Paul, show me the Brittany paintings, huh?
There's plenty of time for that. Come on, let's see.
He's like, oh, I've cooked for you and I've decorated your room. And Gauguin's like, yeah, where are the women? How's this town? He's like, I want to see the paintings. And it manages, again, so clever to not only hit that home that Gauguin is annoyed by Vincent or something, but he's also stunned by Vincent's work. He's clearly now reckoning with this guy that he didn't see as a rival. He's like, shit, this guy has done a ton that I can't really need. Vincent, sort of, let me see what you've done. Let me see what you've done. And he's like, sort of, oh, later, later, later. And he sort of carries that shock into another scene where Vincent's downstairs in the kitchen. Again, the Altman film riffs on that. It's not so original. I mean, the cooking, he's like, and Gauguin goes, oh, you're a little heavy on the turpentine. Like, it's a great joke. Like, that he's, Vincent is such a mess. And he calls him, Kirk Douglas, a brilliant script or whoever came up with this. It's so great. He's like, oh, but Theo, and he's like, oh, I mean Paul. And he's, you can see he's so alone. He's only written those letters. He has nobody to talk to. And all of a sudden there's another guy that is a great, he admires him. It's like a superhero. It's like whoever is your hero, all of a sudden he comes to live with you and you're like, what? It's like you're right there. He can't believe it. And it's all these little delightful things that make sense in the movie and inform you of the real life or heighten it in some way. I mean, I cannot recommend that film enough because it's so, it's just joyful, whether you like Vincent or just Anthony Quinn or anybody. It's just everybody at the height of their craft comes together to make this film. And it's like, and it hits Kirk, like, to add a little RIP to this great actor, that he hits him in this golden period. Like in 51, he did Ace in the Hole. Then he did The Bad and the Beautiful, another Minnelli production. Then he does Ulysses, which is my childhood film. Then he does in 54, he does in 56 Lust for Life, then Path of Glory, then The Vikings.
I mean, this is a really great period for him as an actor. And thinking of a role like Path of Glory, like, again, talking about that vulnerability, I think that's part of what made him a really great actor, is he looked like the tough guy, but he wasn't afraid to be vulnerable and just exposed out there.
Yeah, Path of Glory is obviously, he hits that Van Gogh and Van Gogh in the military or something. He has control. He's not an idiot. He's very deliberate. He's clear. He's clear of what's going on, but he feels that at higher powers are toying with him. He doesn't, you know, he sees things past that he doesn't want, he has no control over. When the mistrial is kicking in and the film creates his own things. When Vincent arrives looking for the light of the South, Arles is a miserable place. Snow is on the ground. It's horrible. It's cold. He's in this dank room. But in the film, the sense makes, he opens the windows and it's spring and he sees the light. Because Minnelli saves the storm, sort of like Kurosawa did. He saves the mistral for the conflict with Gauguin, because he knows later, I will use a visual metaphor for the turmoil of the actors, and I'm going to use that storm again. So that's how great film comes together, because it's not omitted at all. It comes later, how, what a horrible place Isle is and how lonely you feel there. But he saves it for a moment with a big impact. When Kurosawa does this with the rain and a new character is introduced, when the wind comes in Yojimbo, this is all adds up. And these little things add and add and add and add up to give this full painting up. Like every brushstrokes on a painting. And by the way, Kirk Douglas does a great job. The way he holds his brush, the way he slashes at the canvas, he's good. And Anthony Quinn as well, because Anthony Quinn was a pretty decent, for a celebrity actor, painter himself. He's done a lot of good self portraits, and so they're convincing as painters.
Yes. Right?
Which is crucial, because some of them you're like, what are you doing? Like, you know, it's you just end up not showing it at all. I mean, when we see the shoes being painted in Eternity's Gate at the beginning, it's just sort of good enough that I'm like, yeah, okay, but I wish it would have been just really crazy or something else that we would have expected from Schnabel, but it's sort of just like a Van Gogh pastiche or something.
I did kind of like Oscar Isaac as Paul Gauguin, especially when they're kind of bickering, like, oh yeah, Monet has nothing left to give to the world, and Vincent's like, well, I still like Monet. Like, it's like when you meet the guy who's really into movies, he's like, oh yeah, that movie, that's not so great, or this filmmaker, they have nothing else to offer, and you're like, hey, I still like it. I feel like I could relate to that.
There's nothing more to expect from Renoir, Degas, Monet. They repeat themselves. They've given everything they could give.
Oh, you don't mean that. You like Degas. You have to say thank you for the paintings you like. Monet's pretty good.
It's our turn. We have a huge responsibility.
I still think Monet's pretty good.
I wish he would have been another heavy hitter, like pairing Defoe with another older painter, so they're at least on par, because him being so much younger and being like the sure shot Gauguin cocky dude, which fits, but
it changes the dynamic a little bit. Well, there was a... There was also like a Gauguin biopic that came out recently with Vincent Cassel.
Cassel, yeah. How is that? I didn't see that.
It's okay. It's not great.
Vincent Cassel's Gauguin. Like,
he might have been a better Vincent. He looks more like Vincent than Gauguin, but...
Yeah, and I would hope there would obviously all be about like the exoticism and less of the painting, which he was such a great painter, and he was also what a fantastic weird life, stockbroker, and then, you know, making it really big, but then being like a hobby painter, and then actually being one of the outstanding not only painters but draftsmen, sculptures, his, and then just this crazy swashbuckling life, kind of like Caravaggio earlier, where he's just like setting sail on in this crazy time, and obviously comes back to Paris and has this swagger, the way he's introduced in Lust for Life from the back, which is always reserved for like here we go introduction. Yes. And it's so great. A great joyful part in Lust for Life is when he goes sort of goes through the picture book of Paris to meet Seurat, to meet everybody, and Theo's like kind of like this really uplifting part, like live with me and we'll live together and I support you and tomorrow you'll meet Pizarro. And then it sort of starts and, you know, it's Paris. Yep. And then he explains, lays down, this is what I think about painting. They go see Seurat and he's like, I have to do it like mathematically. And it's so informative and fun. I love these anecdotes when that happens, because I always wanted like a Michelangelo film with Raphael.
That always gets me. It's like how they all know each other. Like, I remember first getting into art history and being like, Van Gogh knew Lautrec, like that Lautrec. Like, wait, they all know each other. They're all friends with each other, or like in some cases hate each other. But it's like, you know, when you hear about the French New Wave or something like that.
Downtown 81, where it was not, you were an outsider. There was the Downtown 200, they were called. There was no more. It was like, it was so small. And obviously we're an outsider. And so you bonded together or you hated each other. And I always found that so fun. Like the Agony and the Ecstasy with Rex Harrison and
Heston.
Charlton Heston, my favorite, as Michelangelo. Thomas Millian is Raphael. It's so cool. He comes in as a little cocky Raphael with a little pompadour and it's so cool. I always wanted more of that. And they never get into it enough. And it's like, oh yeah, maybe Dürer appears or something. You know, it's like, who's this German guy painting Venice? And it's like, yeah, but I always want more of that and less. And they fall into a lot of traps because obviously they're looking for the story that has a lot of the sexier elements where he's like, you're clearing off the nightstand. I hate you. And it's the romance. Is the cliche of the biopic, right, which is so overdone. It's like, I really don't want the personal. That's why I appreciate so much almost the weakest part in the Minnelli one is where the studio insisted that they have to make this Cousin K segment. And that's all shot in the studio. I'm not on location. And it's so fake and weird. And you're like, kind of Vincent's like, wants to hug the kid to death. And she runs away. And you're like, okay, this is really heavy handed and doesn't need to be there. The only justification maybe, or it leads to that great candle scene where he's just sort of, you know, holding out in prayer, like proving his love with.
I mean, it does sort of set up his desire to kind of, his attraction to people who need help and him kind of wanting to insert himself into their lives and how that backfires.
Like the CN scene.
CN falling in love with like a cigar chomping pregnant prostitute is maybe a better example of that, but like that's exactly who he was.
And it's played so well because she's sort of like,
it's so sympathetic. Like,
so sympathetic because she's like, oh, you guess you don't want to be seen with me. And that's the moment where he goes, oh, what? And he gets up. Because, of course, for him, that's the moment, like, okay, anything else would have not convinced him, but to not be with the outsider, that's not who he is. And she says that, and he gets up, and we know all we need to know, like, how this is never going to work, but also why it has to happen in that moment.
It's so different from, like, the Altman film, where she's depicted as, like, trashy and just, like, ugh.
Don't paint me when I'm not, like, in pose. Yeah, it's, like, it's really, like, oh, yeah, it's really, that is almost the most unpleasant part.
It's so hard to get through that first stretch of the movie, where, at least when he gets to Arles, like, you know, things sort of open up a bit, but like those interiors where it's dark and it's like, ugh.
Like, how did he not die already of just poisoning? They're all interesting. I want to see more. Definitely the life of Vincent is by far not like exhausted.
You sort of feel like any artist who has something to say about art could make a Van Gogh film. Like Terrence Malick, I would love to see the narration being like reading the letters, almost like how A Hidden Life works with the letters.
Yeah, Malick would almost be my absolute, like you said, my favorite choice, because I think the scenes that really work at Eternity's Gate are Malick-esque, Malick the undulating grass, you know.
And just like reading about Van Gogh's perception of spirituality in nature, to me that Malick could probably capture very well. I mean, you know, if it was me, yeah. I'd want to do just one day in his life kind of a story if I was going to adapt his life into something.
Sort of very much like Seppuku Hashimoto script, which they were all doing these giant samurai epics, and then Hashimoto was like, but what is the day of a samurai like? I want to see getting up, putting on his armor. At least that was his initial idea. Going to work and then dealing with this master and dealing with this shit every day. It's not like this dream of like going to war and all this stuff. It's fucking awful and you have no way out and you come home and it's like a miserable day. The day in the life. And I really love that about the Schnabel beginning where I thought it was going like, yeah, like you said, show us the day. There's enough in that day.
Show us him waking, like what he had for breakfast, his walk to where he goes, how he paints, like show the whole process, like him painting a masterpiece from beginning to end. That's what I would love to see, I think.
In art documentaries, I always want, please, like, please don't slide shoe through this. Show him make coffee. I want to just see how the studio's set up. He doesn't need to paint. I just want to see his mannerisms around, like, getting into it. Because, I mean, Brancusi said that, I think, best. It's not making the art that's difficult. It's getting into the stage of mind that's difficult.
Yes.
And obviously for Van Gogh, it was the walk to the subject. It was that famous road to Tarascon that we see in many of the movies just appear. And I always appreciate it. Even in the PLR when he's walking over the hill, it's there. And it's a famous painting, tiny painting that was lost in the war, never to be seen again. And that's like, it led so many painters, most famously Francis Bacon, to reinterpret that path that he took to the walk in Arles with the beaming sunlight. And it's still such an incentive for us to recreate. Like I said, I made the most posters for Lust for Life because I love that iconic image so much. And that would have been, like you said, like getting there and there's so much into that walk and getting to that stage of mind to be able to work. And obviously including all his doubts and torments and like just not being able to have materials and all that stuff is so interesting and rich. And then again, for me, the letters, it's all in the letters. Just read those. They're just amazing. Have them by your bedside. Open them. I do that sometimes when I feel really bad and I read and I either feel like, oh, it's worse for somebody else, or I feel I pick up on a random, really optimistic one. There's so many really optimistic ones in there where he's full of creative juice and he's like, I'm really getting there. I'm really getting there.
The last stretch of his life, like he thought things were turning around. He was actually optimistic and, you know.
Yeah, that's why people think the murder plot, they give more credence to the murder because they say, hey, look at the last, he's actually.
But I mean, it's also like, I get all the evidence for the murder plot and on one hand, I think it's compelling, but you're also talking about a guy who had a history of mental illness, who had a history of self-harm, who, I mean, it's not normal to be that dependent on your brother. Like, you know, if I have a brother, if he was supporting me, if I felt like I couldn't support myself and he was starting a family, I feel like I would kill myself, you know, like, I mean, that's me projecting, but like, I just, you know, I think like people get excited because this theory is very new, but I think there's also a lot to me that says like, yeah, he probably did kill himself. He might've already had one suicide attempt earlier where he drank a bunch of chemicals.
I think it's just so in lockstep with what that life is like. I mean, I only was at the margins of that, but either through my family or through my father's process, I know what the creative life is like. And those, even though I don't do any drugs or I don't drink or I don't do any of this, it gets so dark. It gets so lonely. It gets really horrible because of obligations with family or not. Or like you said, if I was to be a burden on my parents or my brother who can't get anywhere because of me, it's this stuff weighs as you get older more and more and more on it. And it comes through in the letters too. He feels so horrible asking all the time for money. Sometimes he's like, where's my money? But oftentimes it's just he recreates paintings to show Theo exactly where he is, so to show that he's making progress, and to have that at the back of your mind every day when you go to create. It's deadly. It's horrible. It's not creative at all. It's not freeing. It's, you feel beholden and you're really wrestling with that. I mean, that's why I chose the illustrative path, because I would rather be in service of something and pay homage to the films I love than to shoulder all of that creativity on myself and demand that of my entire family to be with me and to bear with me. And it's really hard and it's real. And I think that's like the films There's a lot to explore still, I think, in that in that story. And it doesn't have to be so direct. I mean, it could be just like taking it as a starting point or something. He's definitely created such a almost unparalleled richness of mythological, from having art history's greatest anecdote of these two masters coming together for this period and painting together and actually exchanging ideas, to the ear, to the love, to the letters, to the brother, to the suicide, to the beautiful paintings, which we always can never forget that we see a lot of it now only in sort of interpreted in the light of his biography and not by his own intentions and concerns, which are in the works themselves. And it's sort of this youth cult that we have in art now is partly because no generation ever wanted to miss out on another Van Gogh. And it's kind of the reaction to that myth, like, oh, he must be good because, you know, we don't want to miss out on the next sensation that we might be wrong about. And that led, over the years, the reaction with the sort of the last de Kooning and those real painter, macho painters with a lot of pathos led to this kind of new approach that we have now, which is very cold and business-like approach to art and conceptual coldness, because nobody wanted to be associated with the tormented genius anymore, because it's hard to burden that on yourself. But, you know, a lot of Achille Gorky killed himself, Rothko killed himself. So this drive has to be burning, really. Like Basquiat be so productive, and just the same. He has like a 10-year period and he leaves this gigantic volume of work. Mm-hmm. He's sort of mini Van Gogh in a way, because even Schnabel was really cool. One of the first preview posters of Basquiat was two wooden clogs, Dutch clogs, which were drawn on and written on by Basquiat, which was a real piece by Basquiat. But Schnabel picked up on it. It's a red poster with the yellow clogs and it says Basquiat is coming or something like that. Or I forget, maybe that's a horrible thing, but it was really a cool signal for me to establish consciously that link onto that young life that burned at both ends with so much passion, so sophisticated, so misunderstood. Schnabel always said a really cool sentence. He's like, he didn't have the tools to circumnavigate the sea of shit. And Schnabel was in a unique position to make that film because he was with him, one of the few people who was with him. He was the successful version of that. He was the guy that made it. And he saw this young kid just coming up, and it's sort of, a lot of people hated Schnabel for that because you're like, you were not a friend of his at the time and stuff. And he was like, still, he felt to make this film to owe it to him that this is shown in the right light. And Jeffrey Wright does a really cool performance. I love that film. It's really cool. Yeah. And it's so sophisticated. Like, it's his first film and bam, there it is. I was like, take Schnabel really serious as a filmmaker, and sort of never, no other film has yet been rivaling this kind of initial impulse, but so much cool, furtive ground still.
I think we've covered a lot of ground just talking on this podcast, but this was an ambitious one. But thank you.
I would just want to, my love forever for Kirk Douglas and Minnelli and Lust for Life is, I will post a lot of this stuff alongside the episode as we always do. I always love this kind of giving a visual guide through what we've talked about and maybe hinting on something that we might have missed. So yeah, you can definitely check that out on our individual Twitter feeds in the coming whenever this is posted. So yeah, thank you for having me on again anytime. For sure. I'm up for more.
Thank you so much for coming on. This episode really meant a lot to me, and I'm glad you could come on to talk about these films. And if folks want to find you online or anywhere, where could they look?
It's mostly what is it? Studio T Stella on Twitter. That's the best, because what we do every day, I think, for all of us, it's been a refuge before this horrible crisis, but now it's even more of us all talking together on Twitter, and it would link always to things I do or posters I do onto websites. Tony Stella film posters, you'll find something.
I'm at Movie Kessler on Twitter, and of course the website's flixwise.com. Folks should check it out, and until next time, take care, listeners.